Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashberry. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1292 features two classic stories by Life Rattle writer Damien Mangat. Damien Mangat was born in London, England in 1971 to parents of Indian descent. She came with her family to Canada when they emigrated to British Columbia in 1977 and worked their way east to Toronto over the next 2 years. Damien got sent back to England to live with her grandparents and then returned to Toronto when she was 16. She began her world travels the next year. Mangat has lived and worked in the Caribbean, Central and South America, Western and Eastern Europe, and Scandinavia. She resettled in Toronto in 1999 and began taking courses towards starting up a freelance editing business while she continued with her own writing. Let's listen now as Damien Mangat reads her first story tonight, Brighton, on Life Rattle. And please be advised that tonight's stories contain strong language and sexual content.
Brighton, by Damien Mangat. The windows rattle in time to the choppy Atlantic. I sip my coffee. The steam swirls around my breath while the cold collects in the corners of our small flat on Madeira Street. The startling gray waves lather the pebbled coastline of Brighton Beach. A solitary nudist, his heavy, hairy belly protruding, looks out over the sea, his hands on each hip, perhaps looking for the same invisible thing I am looking for. This summer morning, on my way to the Bedford Hotel, where I temp as a chambermaid, the wind was calm enough to go without a jacket. By lunchtime, ghostly vacationing Brits were sunning on the rocks. On my way home, rain spun in vicious circles, lifting umbrellas, scarves, and coffee cups. The radio confirms a high of 18 degrees Celsius and a low of 2 degrees Celsius, thunderstorms and sunshine, and gray, gray, gray. The elevator door, which opens directly into our flat, rattles to a stop. Neil whistles, his bag of beer bottles rattling, while he shuts the gate behind him. His tool belt hangs off his rounded shoulder. He is windswept, his hair turning red, brown, and blonde in wisps. His cheeks are flushed, deep into the corner of his dimples. I turn to greet him in all his beauty. "Hey, lass," Neil grins. I smile back at his recently acquired accent. Neil has only been living in England for a year and a half. "Hey, you, want a cuppa?" "Nah, it's lager I'm after." In the tiny kitchen, I search for the coldest McEwan's in the fridge. I reach past the rotting lettuce head, yesterday's leftover curry takeaway, and a curdling pint of milk. "Toss these in too, eh?" Neil pushes the bag across the formica table. "I got some wine, too. I picked up some frozen pizza for dinner, if you're in tonight." I watch Neil pull his striped Hull Sharks rugby shirt over his head. His boyish curls twist around the nape of his neck. His chest arches in a wide stretch. My eyes explore the weave of muscle and veins and hair. "I'm staying in." "Cool. Is there any hot water?" "You've to turn the furnace on again, but there should be some. I just did the dishes." I take the cheap white wine from the fridge and twist the cork. I hear Neil in his room. The familiar whistle, the bang bang as he tosses off his heavy workman boots, the squeak of cupboards opening, the clank of them slammed shut. I watch him as he heads for the bath, dragging a towel behind him, the dip in his back, the smooth arch into his buttocks, the strong, rounded flesh. The past few years have been exhausting, moving from country to country with no particular agenda, taking odd jobs to support myself, hovering between poor and very poor, forlorn, weary, and thirsty. I ended my travels in France 2 months ago with an empty wallet, a wallowing loneliness, and a need for the English language. I hitchhiked to Brighton, surprising Neil at his flat. He answered the door with a white sheet draped around his private parts. Of course he would put up his brother's girlfriend. I moved in with Neil a month and a half ago. Neil is my best friend Darren's brother. Darren and I have been, and occasionally still are, lovers. He lives near my parents' home in Canada, in Kleinburg, Ontario, in a wooden cabin surrounded by plush, deciduous forest. Before I began traveling, Darren and I were inseparable. A strange case of camaraderie and attraction between a 16-year-old insecure Asian and a long-haired, chain-smoking handyman. Neil moved to England after his last attempt at marriage. Ex-wife number 3 bore him children. He lives in England so that he can be near them. I planned to pay rent, but work has been difficult to come by. An occasional temp at the hotel pays me £35 for a full day. I pace the lonely coastline most days, slipping in and out of pubs until I am tired enough to sleep or pass out. I seek out bars to ask about jobs, but usually end up making a fool of myself after a few rounds of free drinks, and I never get the job. I meander alongside the gypsies that frequent the coast from their caravan camps, their dreadlocks soaking in the smell of the sea, the swirl of marijuana from their circles by the fire, the diaperless children wading ankle-deep in the icy, polluted water. I meet them in the welfare office every 2 weeks when I tap into the DSS emergency fund. The street vendors recognize me as I stop to inhale roasted chestnuts or finger a beaded necklace or buy some more rock candy. I find comfort in the Bedford Tavern downstairs. Every night I fill myself with bitter on tap, a pound a pint, and exchange drunken banter with tenants of the resting home down the street. "Ah, that's a good dog, Ruff. Isn't he a good dog? Go on, give him a pat. There, just push the Guinness closer to him. It's a treat. Mind you, back in 1942, I couldn't afford a pint for my dog. Do you have any idea what prices were like back then? No, you couldn't. You're just a young'un." I offer to take old Mr. Farley's Ruff and the other drunk pub dogs out for walks after my head gets too heavy. Neil and I eat burnt pizza, sip wine from chipped glasses, and chug lukewarm beer from cans. "Yeah, shite. So this old Mrs. Richards, eh? I fucking couldn't believe it. Here I am, bent over with my head under the sink, yeah, tapping at the drain pipe, and suddenly..." Neil pauses for effect. "I feel this right pinch on my butt, and I friggin' hit my head on the top." Crumbs splatter over the table as we laugh and laugh and laugh. The wine, the beer, the company make me happy for once. "And she like, when I turns around, she has this look on her old wrinkled face, and she says..." Neil takes a quick gulp of his beer. "And she says, I'm a lot younger than I look. And then you wouldn't believe it. And then she says, my husband won't be back till 7. We fall about the table laughing. Neil radiates energy. I imagine old Mrs. Richards, her heart rate doubling at the irresistibility of Neil's boyish charm, the way his green eyes widen in absolute concentration when you speak to him, the way his tongue dances over his small white teeth luxuriously when he is deep in thought, the way his body moves in natural manly rhythms. Neil chuckles. He licks his index finger and runs it around the plate to collect the crumbs. He pushes it between his lips, sucks on it, and looks at me. "I meant to thank you too, Dee." I find it difficult to look him straight in the eyes, but I try. "What for?" "Oh," I put my hand over my mouth. "You mean with Betty and Ursula?" "Yeah." Neil's cheeks dimple in a wide, warm smile. "What are you going to do about it anyway, Neil? You're going to have to tell Betty something." "I know, but I really hate the idea of hurting her." Despite the pain he regularly causes to the women around him, I don't blame Neil. Despite the lies he tells, there is a childlike innocence around him. Trying to stay angry is futile. Despite the constant fluctuations in his tastes, he really does love each one of those women in his own way. When he makes those promises that he can't keep, he actually means them to come true at the time. It was sort of funny, though, don't you think? Neil blows into his empty can and peers at me mischievously. I guess. It happened 2 nights ago. Ursula, the Dutch girl, who he picked up at the Brighton Marina House Hotel 2 weeks ago, was sleeping over. She was in Brighton on a placement from Rotterdam for a hotel administration course. When she stays over, I drink extra. I need to fall asleep in the silence before the rattling of his bed frame against the wall, the deep-throated laugh of her talking dirty, her fake groans and shrieks of pleasure. 2 nights ago, they were asleep, finally. I was awake and restless in my small room. 4 a.m., the bell rings. It can't be the bell, not at that time, but it was. I pressed the buzzer. Our intercom doesn't work. I didn't think who it could be. I thought they were probably just buzzing for the wrong flat. I went back to bed. Neil, Neil. There was tapping on the door. Neil, Neil. Betty's shrill voice rattled the doorframe. Betty, Neil's fiancée from Northampton. Betty is an overweight secretary whom he met when he was homeless after being kicked out from his previous girlfriends. She worked as a secretary for Lloyd's Bank. I've had lunch with her before. She has large, round, tortoiseshell glasses, a home perm, and a gap between her teeth. She wears lumpy brown turtlenecks and brown socks with her sandals. She's 33. She's never had a boyfriend before. She has never traveled beyond her small town. She used her savings to take Neil on a trip to Mallorca. She lent him the money to get started in Brighton when he said he got a job offer. She has introduced him to her family and to the locals in the pub. She assumed that marriage was the next and only step. Neil agreed. He must have been drunk, or in love at the moment. 2 weeks ago, she quit her 15-year job, sold her house, and began preparing to move to Brighton. She doesn't know Neil. She doesn't understand the way his mind works. She doesn't know about Ursula. But 2 nights ago, she was at the door. I know you're there. I pressed my back against the wall, as if she could see inside through the keyhole. I tried to think what to do. I cleared my throat. Hi, Betty. Just a minute. I rapped on Neil's door. No answer. I turned the knob carefully and peered through the gap into the darkness. Neil, Neil. No answer. I raised my voice. Neil, for God's sake, wake up. Damien, where are you? Let me in. I'm here to see Neil. I know he's here. I saw his company van parked outside. Damn. Neil, Neil. Finally, I hear movement. Neil, what is it? Neil's voice is heavy with sleep. Betty, it's Betty. She's at the door. Neil panics. He hits his head on the headboard as he pushes away Ursula, jumps out from under his covers and stands. He stands there naked, looking at me, sleep and confusion on his face, scratching his head, rubbing his eyes, forgetting he has no clothes on. Neil, what are you going to do? Shit, that Betty. I can't let her find Ursula this way. It'll kill her. I frowned. Betty's banging was becoming ferocious. I have to let her in. But don't worry, Neil. I told Neil to transfer Ursula to my bed, garters, silk thong, and heavy-duty metal makeup case, while I pretended the lock on the door was stuck. Of course, when Betty came in, she was suspicious. She searched the rooms, found Ursula sprawled naked in my bed. Oh, a look of surprise, then relief passed over her face. I didn't know you were, that you liked women. I'm sorry. She backed out the door, her cheeks flushed. Ursula didn't mind Betty's interruption, since Neil had proposed to her during their lovemaking session. Betty was just a crazed ex that he was trying to let down easy without her ending up in the psycho ward, he told her. He told Betty she had to sleep on the couch because he had a highly contagious rash. That night, both of Neil's girlfriends were able to stay over, but Marilyn Monroe was the only female sharing his bedroom, grinning flirtatiously with her skirts twirling, teasing him with her thighs. After that, he set a rotating schedule, which allowed them to stay over on alternate nights without running into each other, until he had replaced them with others. But tonight, Neil is free. I toss the pizza crusts into the bin under the sink. Hey, Dee! Neil's face is flushed with drinking. I just had a brilliant idea. What? I scrape the dried mozzarella off the plates with my nails. I'm going to take you down for a drink. You deserve it, anyhow. We'll shoot a game of pool, too. What do you say? Neil comes over and smacks my bum. I blush. I could use another drink, I guess. That's my gal. We chase each other around the kitchen, swatting at each other with dish towels, and then link arms while Neil starts the first chorus of If I Was a Drunken Sailor, an old Irish tune they play regularly on the ancient jukebox in the pub downstairs. The night opens up and swallows me whole. We drink and dance. I memorize each time his thigh rubs against mine or his hand runs down my back, and I purposely bend over low at the pool table so he might have an appealing view of me between watching him with a growing thirst unmatched by the empties growing across our round wooden table in the corner of the pub, feeling a strange pulse that usually isn't there, dreading the closing, though we are the last ones there, and Mr. Smith is letting us finish our pints. We chase each other along the boardwalk, and he musses my hair. We share a cigarette and play the guess the letter game, drawing with fingers on each other's backs. We skim rocks into the water, and he picks me up and flings me around until, arm in arm, we stagger to our flat, to the elevator, to our small kitchen. He sits wide-legged on a chair, and I don't know what to do, but I do, and I don't want to think, because I know it's wrong and sinful and hurtful to everyone, and I won't be able to look myself in the mirror, and how could we live together afterwards? More girls every day, and Ursula, and poor Betty, and what about my self-respect and sense of decency? Because I love Darren, and the brother idea is sick, and how could I? I should be stronger. I give in. I unbutton my blouse, unzip my skirt, undo the belt, kick off my shoes, unclasp my bra, and drop my slip. I climb onto his lap. I wrap my legs around him. I push a stray curl back behind his hair. I trace his dimples with my fingers. I take his lips with my lips, his mouth with my mouth, his beauty, his warmth, his comfort, his scent, with my body, take him into my bed. I can't sleep all night for watching him sleep. At 5:59 a.m., I return to my room. I don't want to shower for fear of washing away the memory, which is what it has already become. When he wakes, I make him tea and toast, and he tells me about the blonde he met 2 nights ago at a job, who's going to meet him for drinks between his lunch with Betty and his nightcap with Ursula. He leaves, and I don't want to look out the window. I don't want to hear the dripping of the leaky faucet. I don't want to watch my breath rise in the coolness. I don't want to feel the glass rattling in time to the rough, lapping waves. Outside, the startling gray waves lather the pebbled coastline of Brighton Beach. The solitary nudist, his heavy, hairy belly protruding, looks out over the sea, his hands on each hip.
That was Brighton, written and read by Damien Mangat. Mangat's next story moves from England to India and portrays a very different situation for the narrator. Let's hear that story now.
Inside India by Damien Mangat. I wake up, the sheet stuck to me. The ceiling fan whirls, dips, whirls, dips. A lizard sticks to the wall, his head arched, a crusty green smirk, legs bent, green iridescent tail pressed, black eyes unblinking. I kick off the sheets. My watch beats in time to the endless pattern of monsoon rain. No need to look at my watch in a place where time moves listlessly. It's 9 a.m. I pull my feet around to the cold marble floor. I feel for my flip-flops with my toes. I hear the swish-swish of a Bengali woman brushing the veranda with bamboo leaves. I hear the whack-whack of the washerwoman beating the clothes with a wooden paddle. I hear the rain tripping off the hammock outside my room. I hear birds and monkeys, rickshaws honking, and the vegetable man yelling out today's deals. I hear my grandfather's stern cough. I have been in India for 3 weeks, one more to go. My grandfather is 89. I was traveling in France when my family in Toronto contacted me. "Your grandfather isn't well," my mother said on the telephone. "He wants to see you kids before it's too late." My family flew from Toronto to London. I took the Channel Tunnel to Heathrow. We met at the airport and boarded a connecting flight to New Delhi. From New Delhi, we took a private taxi 7.5 hours to Chandigarh, northern India. My grandfather sent his driver to collect us and drive us to his 10-acre house at the base of the Himalayas. In the bathroom, I crouch over the porcelain hole that serves as the toilet. To shower, I shiver under the cold, leaky tap that spits onto the cement floor. The servant girl brings me heated water in a bucket to wash my hair. Another lizard watches me from the corner of the ceiling. In the dining room, the Mali brings me milky chai tea. A trail of ants crawls up the table leg, across the checkerboard tablecloth, up the tomato sauce bottle, and around the lid. "Madam, can I give you some paratha for breakfast? I have some fresh cauliflower and onions." "No, no," I answer in broken Hindi. "I will have the same as every morning." The black barefooted cook darts to the kitchen. I thirst for the water that comes up fresh from the well every morning and afternoon, but I know the cook will be offended if I enter the kitchen to get some. The first day I attempted to take my dirty dishes into the kitchen, he dropped a pan on his foot out of shock. "You mustn't cook or clean or do anything for yourself around here. One or more of the 12 servants on duty at all times will do it for you." The cook returns with a small chipped stone plate. I eat egg sandwiches for lunch every day. I have a sensitive stomach. Spices don't agree with me. The sandwich bread is thin, flat, grainy, and heavily buttered. Stringy egg white leaks out the corners. I take off the top piece of bread. No, no yolk as usual. "Madam, would you like some sauce?" I eye the trail of ants. "No, no, thank you." "Some fresh mango milkshake?" "No, just water." I try to eat slowly to make the time pass. A day here seems like a week anywhere else. My mind churns from the sluggish humidity. My family is still asleep, or walking the grounds under the canopy, or meditating in the prayer room. My grandfather is working in his office. He works as a judge for the Northern India Parliamentary High Court. I climb into the bamboo swing on the patio. The rain trickles lightly. The sun peeps out, but temporarily, it is monsoon season. 2 nights ago, wild wolves came down from the mountains. I don't know how they got across the full river. They fought outside my door in the early hours of daybreak. In the morning, bloodstains mixed with rainwater. I opened Jude the Obscure to the second chapter. I ran out of books to read after the first week here. My eyes refused to move across the page. Everything is lethargy. Everything feels heavy. Everything carries that languid moistness of the monsoon. Despite the rain, I can feel the heat creeping in the sweat-stained arch of my back. My grandfather does not allow women to reveal their arms or legs or neck. Women are not permitted to address men by their first names. Women must remain out of sight when male guests visit. I sit in 40 degrees Celsius heat, in baggy jeans and a long-sleeved blouse buttoned to the neck. Hair must be worn up at all times, in a bun or ponytail. No makeup, except traditional kohl around the eyes. In this weather, it would stream into a muddy mess anyway. Granddad isn't happy about white man's clothing. He disapproves of my Walkman and chewing gum. At 21, I should be married to a prosperous turbaned man and carrying a male hire. Women, he reminded my father the first day we arrived, should have their heads covered at all times in the presence of men. My mum scurried upstairs with a flush on her face to fetch her dupatta. Mum avoids her father-in-law as often as possible. She has short hair. Every morning before breakfast, she drags the comb through her hair as though the motion will make it longer. At breakfast, Grandfather sits at the head of the table. Father sits at the other end. We eat our food to the careful clicking of bent utensils against the plates, the rustle of the cook's footsteps moving back and forth, the occasional throat clearing, the sound of fresh water pouring into dusty glasses. Before I arrived, I looked upon meeting my granddad as an opportunity. I thought he would tell me the story of his life. I thought he would ask me about my life. I thought he would answer all the questions I had for him. But he has yet to address me directly. We sit in the veranda, in the bamboo chairs. The Mali pulls a string attached to the overhead fan that brings ripples of air towards us. How is she in school? Granddad asks my father. Granddad sits directly across from me. I chew on my pinky nail. She's doing well. But she is in arts. Was she not good enough for medicine? Well, she... If a woman does not go into medicine, then she must be married quickly. Sonny, my brother, stabs at a trail of ants with a stick he pulled from the yucca tree. Die, you fucker, I hear him mumble under his breath. In the afternoon, my grandfather summons my 14-year-old brother. My brother doesn't speak Punjabi. My brother isn't fond of reading, writing, or playing chess, or Scrabble, or going for walks, or watching the rain falling, like I am. My brother doesn't care about ancestry, or of questions about grandfather's two daughters, my aunts, who committed suicide in this house. In the afternoons, my grandfather takes his cane, leans on my brother's shoulder, and goes for walks in the rose garden, where my brother throws rocks at the birds. In the afternoons, my grandfather tells the servant to get the chess table out on the porch, sits on one side, places my brother on the other, and patiently tries to explain the rules while my brother swats at flies. In the afternoon, my grandfather takes my brother into his huge, dusty library, ceiling to ceiling with books, and lets him sit at his grand mahogany desk where my brother scribbles cartoons of The Simpsons. I read, I walk, I teach myself to ride the rusty bicycle down the garden paths without hitting the skinny gardener. I watch the charwoman sway on bent knees, brushing the floor, a small black baby attached to her back. I climb five stories up to the precarious top veranda, where I can sit on the stone steps and sketch the mountain peaks. I feel my bones quiver at the sound of monkeys tossing coconuts to each other in the big banyan tree. In the evening, I follow fireflies and inhale the deep, sweet scent of Asiatic calla and arum lilies. Every night, the electricity breaks and starts at irregular intervals. Reading becomes difficult. The family gathers around the special order, battery-powered, black-and-white television to watch Hindi soap operas where overbearing parents force young girls into marriage, where they are abused by in-laws and fall in love with their brother-in-law. The city curfew starts at 7 p.m. every night and ends at 4 a.m. My grandfather's curfew runs 24 hours. Soon, the monsoon will stop. I will be back in English rain. Soon, my grandfather will die. I will not come to the funeral.
That was Inside India, written and read by Damien Mangat. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1292. Arnie Ackman recorded Damien Mangat reading her stories. My name is Virginia Ashbery, and Life Rattle is produced from Toronto and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.